The first change of command at U.S. Cyber Command is complete. General Keith Alexander made way for Admiral Mike Rogers recently. But new revelations from Edward Snowden in Sunday's Washington Post are a reminder that the first 4 years of the combination of Cyber Command and the National Security Agency aren't without controversy. For today's edition of Pentagon Solutions, we turn to William Lynn. He was the Deputy Secretary of Defense when the department stood up Cyber Command. He wrote about the strategy behind it in Foreign Policy at the time. He's now Chief Executive Officer at Finmeccanica North America and DRS Technologies. He explains to Federal News Radio's Francis Rose the chain of events that caused DoD leadership to stand up Cyber Command.
At that point with Buckshot Yankee, the threat there was that of an outside force, in this case a foreign country, that could compromise our networks. And at the time, we decided that we needed to take a number of steps to remedy that vulnerability, which Buckshot Yankee exposed in great detail. And since then, the department's taken steps to greatly improve the capacity of its defenses, and maybe more importantly, has taken the organizational step to stand up the Cyber Command so that we have an organizational focus for cyber offensive and defensive operations.
You and I had our first conversation not long after Buckshot Yankee happened, after you had kind of a chance to understand what was really at the core of it. And I was struck at that time by our conversation and news accounts that it started with a very innocent-seeming incident. Refresh my memory about the details, but I seem to remember it was just simply a member of the service found a thumb drive, plugged it into a network computer, and it had malware on it, and it kind of went from there.
No, that's it exactly. I mean, what we had thought to that point was that our classified networks, which were separated by what's called an air gap from the unclassified networks, from the internet, were well protected and were, I don't know, completely invulnerable, but were very difficult to attack. What we found is that some of the normal behavior of forces in the field was to move material from unclassified computers that had access to the internet to classified. And it could either be information, data they needed, or it could even be family photos, music, something they wanted to listen to. It was relatively, as you said, innocent behavior. But if one of those thumb drives was infected with the virus, as happened, the virus then got onto your classified system.
The piece that you wrote in Foreign Affairs detailed the approach that you took as you and your colleagues at the Defense Department stood up Cyber Command. What major changes in the landscape, in your view, have happened since 2010 to get us where we are today?
Well, I think the biggest change, the biggest event since 2010, since the Buckshot Yankee and the Cyber Command stand up and so on, has been Edward Snowden. That is the thing that has had the most impact on cyber policy, on the whole landscape in the cyber world.
The Snowden incident is well documented. We all know what happened there and what brought that on. I'm struck by the fact, though, that wasn't a technology issue. That revolved around what one person decided in his mind to do based on information that he had access to. It was maybe facilitated by technology because he could download a bunch of stuff onto a small device that he carried around with him. But that wasn't a technology vulnerability. That was a decision-making process.
That's right. I mean, it was a different class of threat from Buckshot Yankee. Buckshot Yankee was basically a foreign entity getting in the U.S. networks from a distance. This was Snowden was an insider threat. In many ways, insider threats are much more difficult to deal with because, by their nature, they're in some kind of trusted capacity. There are technological responses to that, and you see, Admiral Rogers even today was talking about the kinds of steps that NSA is taking, that you're going to have a two-man system to download data, that you're going to have monitors that if you download too much or a lot, that's going to ring alarm bells. So there are things you can do That in fact, when Snowden did this, we were even taking those steps back then, but he either was smart enough or lucky enough to be outside the deployment area of those newer systems. I suspect he was smart enough, but either way, he was outside of them.
But that speaks to a common challenge that not just the Defense Department runs into, but all federal agencies, private sector companies, everybody. And that is that in many cases, understanding the threat landscape can be a very reactive environment rather than a proactive environment. Is that something that you expect to change at some point in the future? Or is that kind of the nature of the game that we'll expect to play for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think it's more the nature of the game in two ways. One is that when you're dealing with an insider threat, you're dealing with one among, you know, many. So you're always going to be at a disadvantage in trying to identify that single individual who might pose the threat out of the thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees or other people with access. The other way, though, in the cyber world, I think it's a particular challenge because the way the internet is constructed is the attacker has most of the advantages. The internet just was not built with security as a principal criteria. And I think that could change, but it would have to evolve over time, that if you had more attention to secure identification, more attention to encryption, I think you could start to shift the balance between the attacker and the defender closer to even. Right now, it very much heavily favors the attacker. And we're never, going to get a defense-dominant world in the internet, but I think we could get something that has more balance.
And I wonder if that would even be desirable, because that would give those who are our adversaries an opportunity to defend themselves more than we would probably like. I mean, at this point, they operate under the same disadvantages that we operate under.
No, that's right. I mean, it's always a two-edged sword. You mm-hmm. exploit advantages and try and defend yourself against your disadvantages.
That idea of that evolution is interesting to me, because I wonder what the not the chain of events, but a chain of events might be that would lead to that evolution, because there are so many people that would find that kind of change undesirable.
Oh, I think you would have to make the change, as I say, it would have to be evolutionary, and you'd have to make it with consciousness about privacy and the other consciousness also about transparency on the internet, consciousness about the ability to expand the internet. Those have all been the characteristics that have made the internet what it is. So you don't want to give up all of the advantages to impose a security regime. But I think had just more attention to the value of those as the internet has become more central to both our security and our economy, I think we could interpose more security without giving up the advantages of the internet.
Let's go back to where we were in 2010 when you wrote this piece in Foreign Affairs. What concepts do you think have stayed the same or consistent, at least, in the 4 years that have gone by?
Well, in terms of the threat, I think the threat that we laid out in the article suggested a progression of the threat that is moving from exploitation, that is theft of information on the internet, into disruption, that's, you know, denial of service attacks we're seeing now on banks and some other commercial entities, and ultimately to destruction. I think we've moved, you know, in 2010, it was mostly exploitation. There's much more disruption now. And I think we have every reason to think that we're going to move up to the next stage, that we're going to see in the future more destruction. So I think that development of the threat has proceeded along the lines that was suggested in the article.
It's almost like a Moore's law of cyber threat. I mean, it's not the same dynamic, the same multiplier necessarily, but the threat level continues to escalate a pace no matter how much time seems to elapse.
Exactly.
You wrote in this piece, the Pentagon's formally recognized cyberspace as a new domain of warfare. It's become just as critical to military operations as land, sea, air, and space. That was controversial at the time. There were some folks that didn't agree with that designation. Do you think that that controversy has dissipated in the ensuing 4 years, Bill?
I do. I think it is far less controversial a statement now than it was then. I continue to think it's a true statement. But I think there was a fear at the time that calling it a domain of warfare would lead to a so-called militarization of the internet. My view at the time, it continues to be that being able to operate in cyberspace is critical for the U.S. to defend itself, both its security and its economy. But being able to operate inside the internet doesn't necessarily militarize the internet, even any more than having a navy militarizes the ocean.
Admiral Mike Rogers, the NSA director and Cyber Command commander, says he can't wait for the joint information environment so the branches of the military can share information and communicate more effectively. The Defense Information Systems Agency says it doesn't have a timeline to roll out JIE, though. Combining efforts of the branches is part of the point of establishing Cyber Command in the first place. William Lynn was Deputy Secretary of Defense when the Defense Department stood up Cyber Command. He's now Chief Executive Officer of Finmeccanica North America and DRS Technologies. He explains to Federal News Radio's Francis Rose the international context he and his colleagues at the Pentagon looked at when they established Cyber Command.
With the Russian efforts in Georgia and before that actually in Estonia, and there was even some in Ukraine, is that I think what you'll see is cyber will be part of any conflict going forward, that there will be a cyber dimension to that conflict, just like there's a land dimension, a sea dimension, an air dimension to the conflict, and different countries will try and exploit it different ways. It won't look the same every time. And I think what that tells the U.S. is we need to do what we did, is we need to set up a formal organization, in this case the Cyber Command, to develop the doctrine, to develop the forces, to resource the forces in an organized way so that we can train and equip ourselves to be able to operate and defend against those developments.
You wrote about the three missions of the newly created Cyber Command at that time. I'd like to review each of those missions and tell me how you think they're doing 4 years on. You wrote, Cyber Command leads the day-to-day protection of all defense networks and supports military and counterterrorism missions with operations in cyberspace. It's a pretty straightforward mission statement there. How are they doing today, do you think?
Well, I think we've made significant strides since Buckshot Yankee. I think we've developed active defenses of our networks. I think we have a robust set of ways of blocking attacks, of deflecting attacks. It's certainly not going to be perfect. It's not perfect, and it's never going to be perfect. But I think it's considerably better than it was in 2010.
Structurally, hierarchically inside the Defense Department, the Chief Information Officer at DOD does not reside in Cyber Command, but my understanding is that Terry Takei had a very close working relationship with General Alexander, and theoretically the new CIO, whoever that person is, will have a very close relationship with Admiral Rogers. Do you like the way that cyber is structured both inside the OSD level of DOD and in Cyber Command, and what those relationships look like?
No, I think the relationships are good. I think the CIO relationship, as you said, under Terry Takei with Cyber Command was very good. I don't expect that to continue. It's a relatively normal relationship in that we have civilian oversight of a military organization, just like we have an assistant secretary for special operations as well as a special operation command. And there can be tensions in those relationships. I don't think we're seeing that right now in cyber, and you need to manage to make sure that there isn't. They're two different roles. But both roles are important to the success of the mission.
The consolidation of the CIO job and the deputy chief management officer job, do you expect that to have any impact on that relationship?
No, I don't think it'll. I think that was more of an efficiency measure. There was a split. Some of the IT responsibility was under the deputy chief management officer, some under the CIO. This consolidates that. I think it's a sensible move. But I don't think it'll have any impact on the relationship.
The only objections that I've heard along that line are there are some folks that are concerned that's such a huge job for whoever gets that combination of those two roles that there's just a lot for one person to manage or a couple of people to manage with an assistant DCMO and so on.
Well, you can say that about a lot of the jobs in the Pentagon. So I think you can find somebody who can do both.
The second mission that you wrote about in this piece is that Cyber Command provides provides a clear and accountable way to marshal cyber warfare resources from across the military. We still have instances where each of the branches and some of the groups are still working through challenges in doing their own in how that meshing together is going to go, don't we?
Yes. But we still have challenges in managing all of our different air forces as well. I think as long as you have a system where you have four services and three military departments and then a set of commands to operate the forces, there are going to be seams, and those seams are an opportunity for inefficiency or worse. But I don't really have an improvement on the system. You can't develop a system where you don't have some type of seams. Mm-hmm. I think we are managing this. And as I said, with whether it's air forces or land forces or cyber forces, there are going to be some overlaps and some gaps. And the goal is to manage those so that they're not fatal.
The third mission that you write about is that Cyber Command will work with a variety of partners inside and outside the government, and you refer just within the federal government to FBI, Homeland Security, Justice Department, DISA, working on site at Fort Meade. That collaboration has gotten a lot of attention, obviously, with you referred to Snowden, and that collaboration has gotten a lot of attention because of the combination of Cyber Command and the National Security Agency. Is it your sense in hindsight that a lot of the uneasiness that people have talked about has maybe been overblown, maybe too strong a word, but it raised people's hackles quite a bit, and I wonder if it raised people's hackles as much as it should have, given what Cyber Command has been tasked to do by DOD and by Congress?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of things in that question. Let me unpack it a little bit. I think what Snowden did is acted on a number of levels. I think one is that his revelations, his actions, I think have shifted the balance between privacy on one hand, privacy policy concerns on one hand, and intelligence gathering concerns on the other. 9/11 shifted it dramatically towards intelligence gathering, and it was seeping back towards the center, I think, over time as privacy concerns were becoming more important. But I think Snowden slammed it hard towards privacy concern. That has become the dominant part of the debate. A second thing and related that the Snowden impact had, I think, is to make it much more costly for private sector entities to collaborate with the government. And there has been a lot of collaboration between NSA and Cyber Command and various IT entities. I think that Snowden has raised the price of that, particularly, I think, for these companies when they operate overseas. And so I think that has caused them to pull back and to say that they will collaborate when ordered by the government, but the kind of voluntary collaboration that marked the period before Snowden is slipping away.
You have spoken in just about all of our conversations, I believe, about the critical role of United States allies. And you wrote about this in this piece in 2010. U.S. allies play a critical role in cyber defense given the global nature of the Internet. The more signatures of an attack one can see and the more intrusions one can trace, the better one's defenses will be. I imagine your position on that hasn't probably changed much given the nature of your view of the world that we've talked about on many occasions vis-a-vis our allies.
No, I think alliance, as in many security endeavors, alliances are very, very important in the cyber world as well. As you indicated, it expands the number of offensive signatures you see, or malware signatures that you see. It allows you to concentrate resources. It allows you to move faster. The internet, the nature of the internet is that you're vulnerable to the weakest link. So if your ally's security isn't up to what it needs to be, and you're connected to them, you're vulnerable too. So I think for all those reasons, we need to continue to work the alliance dimension of cybersecurity.
You refer in this piece to the NATO 2020 study, and now that we're about halfway there, what is your sense of how our NATO allies are doing in trying to make progress in some of the same areas we're trying to make progress with in cyber defense?
Well, I think they've made some progress. NATO has stood up a couple of years before they planned, a cyber operations center, actually with the help of Finmeccanica, our mother company. They've paid more attention to the policy side. I think NATO is at each of their summits. I think they're honing in the doctrinal and policy approach. I would say we're not there yet, and I would say they're probably moving slower than we are. And I think they're not. I don't think there's been the kind of collaborative level, particularly between the government security sector and the private sector. The civilian sector is needed in Europe at this point.